For the week of August 14th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 331, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
Michael, do you feel that we have to do this show really fast, like when world record time? Because, you know, I've been watching the Olympics and everybody does everything really, really quickly.
No, sometimes they poise and they calm and they relax and they breathe because you'll compete and perform better if you are relaxed.
Really? I thought you had to dive over the finish line all the time.
Not always. So we are going to talk about the Olympics, right? What's on tap for this show?
Well, actually, you're right. We're watching the Olympics, just like the rest of the world, by the way. It seems silly when discussing an event that, what, like 3 or 4 billion people will be watching. But, you know, is the Olympics a ratings hit? We kind of talked about it last week, and, you know, there are some more numbers that are coming in. So now we actually have some answers. During Inside Baseball, we'll look at a scathing public letter sent to Warner Brothers by a former employee, albeit an anonymous one, one that mocks their string of bad movies, had Kevin Sugihara's doubling down on the talent that is delivering those movies, and how the 1% at the top of the studio do fine no matter what, while the 99% lose their minds trying to fix problems or just lose their jobs. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who always comes in first place to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our chart from ComScore. We also add in information from Box Office Profits and Mojo and Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, you name it.
And now, of course, the South Korean source that I dug up.
What website is that? Do you know?
Cine 21. It's a movie magazine and movie news site from South Korea.
Yeah, and it helps us with the plots on some of the South Korean movies, though sadly they do not seem to have budget information.
No.
But pulling in info from all those people, we know that the number one movie around the world is Suicide Squad, another $100 million over the weekend. It's at $465 million worldwide. Clearly, it will get to profitability.
Yes, and, let's face it, it dropped 70% in its second week in North America alone. So
not quite as much if you pull out the Thursday numbers, but yes, it did drop hard. I was looking at the weekday numbers where it was making over $10 million, and I was thinking, hey, this is going to have a good hold. So that did not prove true. It seems like everybody went to see it early on. Even if it wasn't on that first Thursday or Friday, they did go Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Everybody that wanted to see it has seen it, but it's still making $100 million. It's going to be a profitable film.
No matter what the critics say.
Then, well, look at Transformers. And number two around the world is The Secret Life of Pets, another $50 million for this franchise. And yes, that's exactly what it is, $600 million worldwide. At number three, a new movie. A new movie, an original film, just like The Secret Life of Pets. It's Sausage Party, an animated comedy about food wanting to get it on, I think is the essential idea here. It's created by Seth Rogen. It made $36 million over the weekend. It only cost $20 million to make. Good reviews. Some people went to see it who were expecting Toy Story, I guess. So the audience score isn't great, but the people who like it love it. And I'm looking forward to seeing it.
I can tell you that just because it's an animated film, or as children say, a cartoon.
Well, it's R-rated.
Doesn't mean, yeah, you only find that out after you're...
It's not, it's about hot dogs and buns having sex. It's not that confusing. People knew South Park was a dirty film, not for little children. I think it's very, very clear that Sausage Party...
They should make that more clear.
Okay. Did you take your kids to Sausage Party?
No. That was the joke I was going for, but no, I did not.
Thank God for that. And number four is Jason Bourne, a franchise that has not been revitalized by Matt Damon. $32 million over the weekend, $250 million worldwide. At number five, Pete's Dragon, a Disney live-action family film with a soft, low-key approach to storytelling. It's like the old days. $26 million it made on its opening weekend, which is a very good start for a film that got very good reviews and should have good legs.
I can't wait to see it, actually.
I may go see it tomorrow night. It's a double feature at the drive-in for $4. You get to see two movies, and I may go to the double bill of Pete's Dragon and Finding Dory.
Ah, that would be a good little double bill there. I wonder, how do they show Sausage Party at a... You know, at a drive-in, you know, because sometimes the drive-ins, there's like four screens going at the same time.
Well, that's exactly what there are here. You have four different screens. They're in different areas. You know, you're facing your screen. Your little children go to the food court, I suppose. They might glance over and see some violent scenes from Jason Bourne or whatever, but they'll live.
Okay, and how's the audio?
The audio is great. It comes through your car. You know, your car stereo.
Perfect.
Yeah. And number six is our first international film. It's Line Walker. This is a Hong Kong Chinese crime drama, and it's spun off from a TV series about super hot cops going undercover. They're all very good looking, only to discover there's a mole in the police force that may reveal who they are. Big hit TV series, catchy premise. Now it's a big film. It opened at $26 million over the... I beg your pardon. It opened on a Wednesday, I think, or a Thursday, because it made $26 million over the weekend, but it's at $35 million so far. It's in five territories. Sounds like a premise. I'm surprised Hollywood hasn't snapped it up yet, and maybe they have.
Yeah, they have. It's called 21 Jump Street.
No, that's not the premise. They're not in high school, and it's also the guys on 21 Jump Street were not finding out that they were about to be revealed as, you know, secret agents.
Yeah, I was just going with the, you know, the 1980s version of, like, you know, super hot cops undercover.
Well, there aren't many movies about cops with unhot cops.
Yeah, that's true.
At number seven is Bad Moms, another $17 million over the weekend, $85 million worldwide. At number eight, another international film, it's Love 020, or sometimes it's translated as Just One Slight Smile is Very Alluring. It's a Chinese romance about college students based on a novel. They seem to fall in love online or while role-playing online. It wasn't clear to me while I watched the trailer, but I don't know why they would have to meet online, because just like the cops in the previous film, they're extremely attractive people. So there's no reason why they shouldn't just meet in real life. It's not like one of them is, you know, ugly. That made $17 million over the weekend. And number nine is Tunnel. This is a Korean drama about a man trapped in a collapsing tunnel, and it becomes a media sensation. You see these stories every once in a while. I think this is just an original story, but, you know, child falls in well, the miners trapped in Chile, you know, the Ace in the Hole, the classic Billy Wilder film. People trapped and then, you know, trying to rescue them can become this massive, you know, media phenomenon, and that's what this film seems to be about. The guy seems to be learning he loves his family at the same time. That made $15 million on its opening weekend. And number 10, another Asian film, it's Call of Heroes. This is a Hong Kong period action movie. It made $12 million and it cost $32 million to make, so it's got a pretty good start. It's about villagers in the early 1900s rebelling against their evil warlord. I didn't know warlords were still around in the early 1900s, but apparently they were. And the action scenes are overseen by Sammo Hung, the great Hong Kong action star.
Well, wouldn't they have been called gangsters at that point?
Well, I'm just using the words that I saw.
Okay.
And number 11 is Time Raiders, the Chinese adventure supernatural Tomb Raider movie starring Lu Han. Another $12 million over the weekend, $120 million worldwide. Looking down below, we got a lot of Hollywood movies. Ghostbusters made $10 million. Finding Dory made another $10 million. That's just approaching $900 million. I'm not sure what territories it has left. It's still making $10 million a week, but will it get to $1 billion? It probably needs another big opening or two, right?
Well, I think in France, I don't know if it's opened in France. Oh, yeah, it has opened in France. I take that back. Actually, in France, they don't necessarily go by money. In fact, last week, we have news here that Suicide Squad became the 13th feature film this year to break 1 million admissions. So they go by admissions.
Which is awesome.
And it did it in 1 week.
Wow. So, looking at Ghostbusters right before that, that's at just under $200 million. And then we have Star Trek Beyond, which made about $10 million. That's just over $200 million. Ghostbusters is seen as a terrible flop. Star Trek Beyond, I think people are sort of given a pass to. But if you're actually doing the books, no one's going to lose their shirt, but this is not a successful movie so far. It really needs to pick it up overseas. It probably has a long campaign to go. That's where it's been making its money with the last two films. It's definitely underperforming in North America, but it needs to pick it up big time in the rest of the world.
Well, speaking of doing the books, you know, what do you make of this story in the Hollywood Reporter about Ghostbusters possibly taking a $70 million plus loss, and that certainly a sequel is off the table?
Well, that's just an accounting thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're looking, and this was a story by Pamela McClintock, and she was looking at basically, you know, what the budget was, and I guess it was, it earned $117 million domestically and is up to $180 million worldwide.
Or as we just reported, $195 million.
Yeah, and it needed, okay, so there you go. So it needs to get to $300 million, some say, to break even.
Well, is that what the studio said? Because this movie made was budgeted $145 million. And that means we would say it's got to triple that. As far just to be a big box office success, it doesn't mean that we'll lose money on it if it doesn't triple it. So break even in their sense means they're saying, okay, we'll also make DVD, we'll also make video on demand, we'll also sell it to cable. So when they say we'll be profitable if we double our budget, they're looking at all the end games. So when we talk about a movie being a big hit at the box office, we're talking about just making your money back and being in profit just from the get-go before all those ancillary markets kick in.
Right. And to answer your question and to your point, so I'm going to do two things here. I'm going to answer your question because it was a studio representative who said that the break even would be $300 million, okay, mm-hmm. on Ghostbusters. And another rep, unnamed anonymous rep, said, look, this calculation that you have is way off with multiple revenue streams, including consumer products, gaming, location-based entertainment, continued international rollout, and huge third-party promotional partnerships that mitigated costs, the bottom line, even before co-financing, is not remotely close to that number. And I can tell you that I've spoken to a number of CFOs for production companies and different distributors who say the same thing, that like these calculations of, oh, the movie lost money because it didn't do well at the box office, are usually way off because of all of these, I don't want to say mitigating circumstances or mitigating factors, but of all the different revenue streams
yeah.
that aren't taken into account.
Well, they're off only because they keep them secret.
Well, but yeah,
you have to make a blind in the dark guess when they refuse to tell you anything, don't you? Even the budget is a source of speculation. We claim it's $145 million, and a lot of movies we don't really know.
Yes, and sometimes they'll try and under-report the budget. If they kind of report anything, they'll kind of go
under.
Well,
keep all this in mind when we get to Warner Brothers, because when you're talking about whether a movie is a hit or a flop, saying it has to triple its budget worldwide is just a very rough estimate of a movie that you consider a home run. It has nothing to do with the movie losing money on the accounting books. And God knows, even if it's a home run, it may never make money in the account. They've got lots of sets of books in Hollywood, don't they? They're here saying, oh, you people are so stupid. You don't realize we have lots of different ways of making money on this movie. We're not going to lose any money on it. But then if you're a profit participant and you're a net profit participant, they say, oh, I'm sorry. I know it was a massive worldwide hit, but we're still not in the black. So, yeah. They're having their cake and they're eating it too. We don't know a lot of the numbers. We do recognize that there's lots of different revenue streams, but there's no way to point Ghostbusters as anything other than an unsuccessful movie. It didn't make a lot of money. It's not going to lose their shirt. Will they make a sequel? No. Should they go up forward with the animated TV series? Not unless they've got some really good different idea that's making them dying to do it, because right now, nobody wants to watch it.
Yeah, I agree. However, people are watching Train to Busan, which I was surprised didn't make the top, what is it? We kind of looked at the top 20, or what did we look at?
Well, it's in the top 20. It's number 26 worldwide.
Ah, so okay.
When you're looking at worldwide box office, it's pretty easy for a movie to drop off that chart. Train to Busan grossed $3.5 million over the weekend. It's at $76 million. And this is the Korean film about zombies on a train.
Yes, that is. It's, Snakes on a Plane was the American version, I suppose. I'm kidding, of course. But this is Zombies on a Train. That's right. But it's actually doing gangbusters in Korea. It's made $66 million in 2 weeks domestically, which is really, really good. And the thing is, it's actually kind of reflecting the present day reality of South Korea. That's why a lot of people are saying, look, it's kind of making it's social commentary through
film. It's striking
film.
A nerve. It's not that it's reflecting reality. There aren't zombies on trains, but it speaks to the people.
Right, exactly. And,
That's what horror films do, don't they? So what is it speaking to the Korean people about in this movie?
Well, the fact that the stratification of society and the competition in their present day society and citizens, the elite versus the underclass. Is that what you're asking?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
This movie is speaking to them.
Well, all of those things. So basically the high unemployment and the inequality in the Korean society presently.
And there's a sense that the elite do not care about the people. There was in July, a high-ranking official in the country's education ministry, this is according to the LA Times, caused a furor when, while having drinks with a bunch of reporters, again, he's having drinks with reporters, people who write stuff down and report on it. He said 99% of South Koreans are like, quote, dogs and pigs, end quote. That didn't go down so well.
No, you probably should not be drinking while you're talking to a reporter.
Well, that is a I'm just reading a book called Soul Man, S-E-O-U-L, about a guy who worked for a major car company, an American who went to Korea to work for a major car company as international PR. And he's like, no, that is the culture. You go out drinking and everyone needs to buy you a drink. That is, you know, that is part of the business culture, he says.
Ah, well, maybe the reporter should be drinking too, so they can't remember the fact that you called, you know, 99% of their population dogs and pigs.
So it's interesting that they're looking at this movie, seeing it as a hit, and seeing it as speaking to a larger, you know, ill in society. But that's what great horror movies have always done, whether it's, you know, Dawn of the Dead or the one set in a shopping mall that sort of commented on consumerism, the dread of the other that you see in a lot of horror films. So this is what a good horror movie will do. They don't just boo and scare you. They sometimes really strike a nerve and speak about cultural issues.
Well, whether it's Train to Busan or Line Walker this week was number six, the Chinese film with the hot cops, as you called them, yeah. Or Tunnel, another Korean film. You know, I just want to see these films, and it's really difficult to actually see them.
Well, it's less difficult today, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, you're seeing, I just got an interview request from a publicist in London who called me and said, hey, we've got these Bollywood stars coming to America to promote their movie. Won't you please interview them? And they sent me two emails and I never responded because it seemed like a group email. Then they called me directly and they said, we're having trouble finding anybody to talk to them. And I was like, you know, hey, I'm a freelancer. Nobody pays me to write anything. But I thought, wow, that's kind of surprising. I said, because they're playing in New York now. These movies are in the mainstream theaters. They're not just in the Asian cinemas in Little India. They're playing at, you know, AMC 25. And they're playing here in Birmingham, Alabama at the local Summit 16. There are Bollywood movies, two of them right now playing. And that's happening all over the country.
You know, so what? I got that same email that you got.
Right. But I mean, if you look at the listing for AMC 25 and Empire in Times Square, you will see Bollywood movies. You will see Asian movies more and more day and date when they're coming out because fighting piracy and, of course, make them available. If you show them, people will come.
Yeah. Now I'm just going to have to download it over BitTorrent. No, I'm just kidding.
No.
I'm just kidding, people. Besides, all those BitTorrent sites were closed down.
That's right. If you look at AMC 25, Mohenjo-Daro is playing. Operation Chromite is playing. Train to Busan is playing at 8:10 and 11:30 p.m. tonight at AMC 25 in Times Square. As is Bazodi, which I don't even know what that is.
Okay. Is Train to Busan playing in Birmingham, Alabama?
It is not playing yet this week, but there are two Bollywood movies.
Okay. Well, it doesn't matter because nobody's going to have time to go to the movies.
Well, that's a surprise. You know, we're talking about the box office, and we haven't mentioned this worldwide box office is happening during the 2 weeks of the Olympics, which can really depress box office and other events because everybody's gathered around their TVs.
Yes, but then they realized, you know what? They're just going to give it to that Phelps character, so why bother?
That's right. Well, the Olympic Games have begun, and it's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, not the medal race necessarily. We're not really talking about that. No, we're talking about the ratings race. The Olympics is a guaranteed massive ratings grabber every 2 years. Worldwide, some 3 billion to 4 billion people will watch at least some of the games. How's that for a widespread, by the way? 3 billion to 4 billion. You know, it's like give or take a billion. Yeah. But the Olympics also shines a spotlight on the changing viewing habits of really the world.
That's right. So how are the ratings worldwide?
Well, you know what? Specifically, if you were really going to calculate it down, we have no idea.
How are the ratings in North America?
Well, that's funny because in North America, as a matter of fact, we don't really know that yet either.
This is what the reporting of it I'm really upset with at the Hollywood Reporter and Variety and other places. They're covering the ratings every day. I've left little notes, you know. As a side note, these websites are taken over by right-wing people who just use every story as an excuse to talk about right-wing politics. I don't know why. I don't know what their point is, but they do. They just start making right-wing noise. But anyway, even at the Hollywood Reporter on a story about the Olympics, anyway, they're not making clear when they're talking about overnights on NBC or overnights on NBC and cable, live plus three, live plus seven. I haven't seen any mention or any caveat saying, hey, you know what? These are their overnight ratings. We're going to be adding more people when we get, you know, live plus three and live plus seven. It'll take us this many days to find out or that many days. NBC has a new metric. You know, it's very confusing. And with more and more people using DVRs and live streaming, it's really hard to know who's watching what.
Well, I mean, look, you know, maybe in I look at this as a transition Olympics. OK, maybe not so much Sochi, but the Summer Olympics always kind of rated higher anyway, as far as people watching for the most part.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So this is a transition Olympics where we're moving away from one network with live or tape delayed coverage and moving toward numerous networks, usually, well, in this case, in the U.S., all owned and run by NBC, as well as basically you can watch anything at any time live online.
Well, that's new. But as far as multiple cable channels, we've had that for a number of years where we've had programming on, you know, multiple NBC stations and multiple AB, you know, that's been going on since cable has been around. You know, they've really been making it, taking advantage of it and saying, hey, you know, so we've been seeing more and more, you know, hundreds of hours of Olympic coverage. Now we're up to thousands of hours, and literally every game is available to watch live if you want it.
That's true. Yeah.
That's kind of amazing. And so we are getting numbers. The numbers for live streaming are really huge. They passed London's entire live streaming very, very quickly. We're now up to, I think, 2 billion minutes. Early on, I got a factoid that said about 11 million unique viewers had come to watch online streaming video. I haven't seen any update on that. I assume more and more people have discovered it's happening, have gone into it, have watched it, and done it. So I assume we're up to 15 or 20 million people that you can add in to as far as the eyeballs that are watching the Olympics.
And now we're just talking about North America right now, because you know we've checked for the BBC ratings and the BBC iPlayer ratings, and we couldn't find that. However, in France, we did get some ratings, right? I mean, we saw that at least for the opening ceremony, there was 1.6 million spectators watching, or 1.64 to be exact, which was 26% of the audience share. Now, what's noteworthy here, okay, is that it aired live from 11 p.m., to 3 a.m. in France.
Right, and it was way down from London because London was taking place in their time zone.
Oh, yeah, every 2 hours earlier.
Every Olympics is different because of where is it, the time zone, and that affects everybody all over the world. Here's some things we know. For prime time, the Olympics remain a huge draw. They have been for 40 years now. That's not changing. Some go up, some go down. These Olympics are, you know, we've got a lot more technology in play, like DVR and live streaming and multiple cable channels. For the first time in history, in North America, they are airing live events in prime time on cable channels that are different from the live events being shown on the network package. So that's new. As of day 10, the prime time average on NBC is 27.8 million viewers, about 28 million viewers. That's down about 18% from London, where they were averaging 33 million viewers. But I don't know if that 33 million were the final numbers or the overnights. And I don't know if this average ever includes any live plus three. But we know tens of millions of people are watching every night. It's 28 million people. It's down a little bit from London, but that's a perfectly normal thing. Cable channels are hitting record highs. The Olympics app is a hit. Live streaming is a massive, bigger than ever factor. And NBC is pushing a new metric called total audience delivery that tries to combine how many people are watching in prime time, cable prime time, cable day parts, live streaming, and more to add up all those eyeballs and give a sense of how many people are actually watching the Olympics on any platform that they provide. And so far, I don't really hear what that total audience delivery is.
Well, and here's what I would say. Much like laws in the legal system often trail society as a whole and the social norms as a whole, I would say this measurement of viewership as we, you know, go through this transition from just television to television and cable, and now television, cable, and digital, you know, online streaming.
Yeah. It's always changing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to trail the measurement methods will trail the methods by which we can actually watch this stuff. And look, I was on a plane. I saw the guy next to me was watching rugby live while at 30,000 feet, he was watching the Fiji play New Zealand in rugby. I couldn't believe it. On his little laptop, on his iPad.
That's amazing. And on the reverse side, there are so many more options that achieving the same level or even 18% fewer in prime time is a huge win. 20 years ago, literally 20 years ago this week practically, or you know, 20 years ago in the fall season, ER would reach about 30 million people a week as the number one show in the country. I mean, that was the number one show, so that's great. And you've got Game of Thrones. If you add it all up, they get close to that too. But, you know, doing that in prime time for 17 days in a row is a big accomplishment. And how much is their advantage over the other networks? Most other networks in North America are playing dead. They're running reruns, just like they always do, because the Olympics is a huge event. Even still, their advantage over the other networks is the second biggest in history, trailing only the 2012 Olympics. You know, right, so it's down from the 2012 Olympics. Those ended up being the most watched TV event in U.S. history, partially because we have a bigger population, but it was also a big draw. More than 200 million people watched at least some of the 2012 Olympics.
And you mentioned, Michael, that there's some live events going on during primetime in the U.S. And just going back to France.
On other cable channels.
On other cable
and
channels.
And, of course, online, too. Everything is available.
Well, yeah. And I noticed that the swimming took place at night. And there was a reason for that. But
Oh, you mean why do they have these events pegged to air in prime time in North America?
Right. Exactly.
When it takes place in Brazil. It's sort of the same time zone, so it's not as big an issue this year. It's not that much time shifting. But they even have beach volleyball late into the night.
Right. And so in Europe, they're saying, well, wait a second. Why is this all taking place at night when we're asleep, you know, or we have to wake up really early or go to bed really late to watch, like, the gold medal rounds?
And even when it's in Europe, sometimes events take place in the morning or afternoon, again, to make sure that they air in prime time in North America. Aren't we obnoxious?
Right. Why are American viewers so advantaged when it comes to the Olympics? And there were tons of stories in France. And basically, it boils down to this. Hey, you know what? NBC paid $12 billion to broadcast the Olympics, the Summer Games, through 2032, and no other network and no other television networks are spending that much money. So they basically
down to money.
Yeah, it comes down to money.
They paid $1.3 billion for these Olympics, these particular Olympics, to air them in North America, or in the U.S., I should say, right?
Yes.
So, you know, and you spend the most money, you get to have more influence on when events air.
And they sold a record $1.2 billion in advertising before the games even began. The issue now will be that they sold those ads at a rate at which the viewership should have been higher. They were
I don't know about that. I've seen back and forth on the make goods. NBC guy said, no, our advertisers are happy. We have enough inventory to help people for any make goods we have to do. I'm sure they did not promise record ratings. So, you know, the fact that they're down from London wouldn't be a shock. So, again, we're in the dark. They're not announcing what their levels were that they sold at. I assume they're not remotely as big as, you know, the London 2012 record ratings. So, you know, are there make goods? They say, we're fine. We've got inventory to make up some of it. Most of the advertising is not falling short of the make good level, and we won't have to make it up.
Okay. And a make good is when you sell an ad with a certain viewership level. You don't hit that viewership level. You got to give that advertiser another ad during either the same event or...
Right. So if is hitting 30 million people a week, you're not walking into the season guaranteeing 30 million people a week. You're probably guaranteeing 23 or 24 million.
Right.
And, you know, you lock it in the beginning of the season. It turns out to be bigger than expected. Everybody's happy. If it's a little bit lower than the 23 million, if the show falls hard for some reason, or it's a new show and you overestimated what it would do and you'd always be very conservative, in that case, you need to do a make good, which is okay. We only reached 21 million people. We need to give you that value of the number of eyeballs you're missing somewhere else. And in this case, I imagine they're saying, hey, we'll throw your ads on our live streaming site. We'll throw your ads on our cable channel. They got a lot of inventory to offer up, don't they?
Yes, they do.
And I can't tell you how happy I am about these Olympics because I got to geek out.
Why is that?
I have been buying USA Today every Wednesday for 20 years, more than 20 years, since 1992 when they launched. Because every Wednesday, they have the Nielsen ratings in a nice little chart. It's better than anybody else in the world. It's the easiest way to see what aired in prime time and what they scored in the overnights. Because that's what they had. And back in 92, the overnights were all there kind of was. They didn't have DVRs and they weren't measuring VCR usage. Anyway, I said, I wonder what the other Olympics did. You get some averages of what they did overall. But I went back and pulled out, yes, I have the Atlanta Olympic charts for the 2 weeks that the Olympics aired. I have every night listed there. So I went back and you can look in our show notes for Atlanta. I have the ratings for the opening ceremony, day one, day two, day three, the closing ceremony. I did the same thing for Sydney in 2000. I did the same thing for Athens in 2004. I did the same thing for Beijing in 2008. 92, I did not have because USA Today started publishing literally weeks after the Olympics ended.
Okay.
And I don't have 2012 yet. Because I haven't turned those into PDFs.
So oh, I have hilarious.
Physical charts. But you can go back there and what you'll see is just as an overall thing. In 96 in Atlanta, they averaged 32 million viewers. In 2000 in Sydney, 22 million viewers. At which point people would scream, the Olympics don't matter anymore. Oh my God, they dropped by so much. In 2004 in Athens, they averaged 24 million viewers. In 2008 in Beijing, 27 million viewers. And then in 2012, they averaged, as we are told, 33 million viewers. Now we're looking at 28 million viewers. That's more than the average for Beijing overall, for Athens overall, for Sydney overall.
Well,
so, you know,
I mean,
what?
At the end of the day, it's you're averaging over 20 million viewers per night on a sustained level. So it's not like, well, it was 20 million viewers for an hour and then everybody tuned out. It's 20 right. million viewers, above 20 million viewers.
For 17 days.
For 17 days for 3-4 hours a night.
In which you're running lots of ads for your TV shows.
Oh my God. You have no idea. Literally, yeah. They're, you know.
Well, I watch it all on DVR. I do not. I rarely watch it live.
It's just, it's maddening.
I just try to avoid the front page of the Times. Why they can't say, click here to find latest Olympic updates. They're like, we're not in the business of helping NBC. So they don't mind spoiling your prime time.
Spoiling it. They send it straight to my mobile phone with some alert. You know, Michael Phelps wins 29th gold or whatever it was. I was like, oh, thank you so much. That hasn't aired yet.
Well, so we'll have final numbers later. Hopefully we'll get more info on Live Plus 3. Because I think with all the ads and the fact that it's 4 to 5, 6, 8 hours of programming a night, especially if you're up late night watching beach volleyball and other stuff like I am, who the heck isn't using their DVR? I know some people aren't, but I would think typically for a live sporting event, you don't get a big bump from DVR usage. I would imagine the Olympics, because it's for 17 days and there's so many hours of it, I imagine that case, DVR will be a bigger factor.
Well, is it going to be a big deal then or a big whoop?
It'll be a big deal.
Okay, that was my weak way of getting us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. I suppose if there was a gold medal for segues, I would not have won it.
Keep going.
Our first story, Michael, this has you written all over it. Entrepreneur Arianna Huffington, you know her, Michael.
We're good friends.
Yes, because of course you're over there at the Huffington Post. She is leaving the website that bears her name just 1 year after signing a much touted 4-year contract. Huffington is leaving to launch a new business about health and wellness called Thrive Global. Her goodbye email to staffers even managed to work in a plug for her new venture as a reason for leaving. With zero experience in media other than as a talking head on TV, Huffington launched a site in 2005 to do for the left what the Drudge Report did for the right, and that is aggregate news and give a megaphone to issues important to the left. It did much more than that, becoming one of the most popular media sites in the world, building one of the biggest staff rooms around when most companies were cutting back. They won a Pulitzer Prize, and they netted Arianna Huffington, the businesswoman, a huge payday when she sold the website for more than $300 million to AOL. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it is a big deal, right? I mean, they said, oh, she'll be around for years to come. Ah, goodbye.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a rough transition. Huffington Post is very different from what it was just 2 years ago. It looks more like the Daily Mail. They're phasing out bloggers, the people who used to, you know, complain, why aren't you using us more? Why aren't you paying us? Well, guess what? Now they're not even showcasing you. If you go to certain sections like entertainment, you don't even see the bloggers anymore. So a lot of changes happening on Huffington Post. And Ariana's leaving is just one of them.
Now, did you get an email when this occurred?
Oh, God, no. I'm not a staffer on Huffington Post. They have a strict wall between the bloggers, the people who choose to voluntarily use that platform to promote stories they want to promote, and the people who are on staff. And to their credit, they do have one of the biggest newsrooms in the country covering news, but the bloggers are not part of that.
You know, what's interesting is back in when she started this, 2005, we at Film Stew had been, actually it was before this, it was like 2003. She was looking for real estate, or, you know, basically office space for her new venture.
Her new startup.
And so we kept running into her everywhere because we were looking for office space for Film Stew. And she, we were thinking, and then, you know, 2 years later, we were thinking of moving out
maybe
of our office space.
Maybe you should have gotten
space.
To work for her.
Maybe, yeah. Although I don't know if I would have benefited from the $300 million payday, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. Now, Adele, you know, Ariana Huffington is big when it comes to this whole news thing, okay? But Adele is big when it comes to music. She is the biggest act in the world at the moment. So naturally, the Super Bowl wanted to sign her up for the halftime show, which I immediately, when I read that sentence, I thought to myself, yeah, that's not a good idea. After the rumors continued to spread in the UK tabloids, Adele shot them down in concert with her usual self-deprecating charm, and she said, quote, I mean, come on, that show is not about music. And she said that in an aside captured on video at one of her concerts. She went on to say, and I can't dance or anything like that. They were very kind. They did ask me, but I said no. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Yeah, she said no. Let's face it. I think it's actually a big deal that she had enough smarts to say no.
Yeah, it would. Like she says, she's mostly about the ballads, so that's not a real great fit for the Super Bowl.
Yeah, could you imagine Barbara Streisand playing at this year's halftime show?
Well, Diana Ross did.
Okay, but she has some upbeat songs.
Well, they all do, but you know.
Okay. I can't see it. Robert Downey Jr., he is returning to TV. The creator of True Detective has a new project. And yes, they're teaming up. Weirdly, it's not season 3 of True Detective, but an entirely different project. Even more weirdly, it's that most traditional of TV formats, the courtroom drama. But wait, there's even more weirdness. The likely project? A reboot of Perry Mason, which Downey Jr. has been working on for years as a movie and now thinks will work better on TV. Details are slim, but it's going to be a TV series, not a series of films. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for them that the HBO landed Downey Jr. and the creator of True Detectives. It's the least quirky, strange idea I've ever heard of. Perry Mason. Like, what the heck? What a bizarre thing for him to be passionate about.
I did like your little twist there, but wait, there's more, because that's like the whole Perry Mason thing.
That's right. So there's just no confusion about going back and forth between TV and movies. That has been dead for many years and is deader than ever. John Krasinski of The Office, he made the movie 13 Hours. That wasn't a movie. That was an audition, because he's going to play Jack Ryan, not in a series of new movies, but in a TV show for Amazon. Jeffrey Rush is playing Albert Einstein for National Geographic. There's just fluidity all over the place.
Have you seen Jeffrey Rush? No, it's Christoph Waltz in these commercials during the Olympics.
Yes, I have.
I'm like, what are you? You're a two-time Academy Award winning actor. What are you doing in commercials?
What do you mean? Making money.
Yeah, I guess.
He's never had a big payday as a movie actor.
That's a good point.
And they're not very good. I don't really like the ad. I think it's bizarre.
The legendary, well, kind of like his acting sometimes. So
his acting is great.
Well, I know, but he plays bizarre characters sometimes. The legendary hip-hop group De La Soul has a new album coming out on August 24th. That's cool, say their fans, who helped fund it via Kickstarter to the tune of $600,000. But where are the old albums? In a fascinating piece in the New York Times, and it really is worth a read, the Times detailed how the band's 6 early albums have never been available legally in a digital format or via streaming. It's like the band has disappeared. Some blame Warner Brothers. Others, namely Warner Brothers, say it would just be too darn hard and expensive to clear the samples they used for digital use. And the rest say, I just want to hear 3 feet high and rising on something other than my old audio cassette. At the very least, fans will be able to check out the album and The Anonymous Nobody, which is the name of the album, on August 24th. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. They've got a new album, though they haven't had a lot of heat for many years. I was kind of wondering where the heck 3 feet high and rising was myself, so I'm glad to learn about this. It is You know, you do have to feel like surely it could be done, Warner Brothers, if you cared.
Yeah, that's really the they can't.
But why wouldn't they care? There's a lot of money that they've left on the table by not being part of the digital streaming, you know? They've talked about, you know, ringtones from some of their songs. That would be perfect fits for that. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, it's also a lot of work to go and get the rights to every single sample.
It's work, Ben, and you make money. Have you been watching? And they fell in that nether region where it was just sort of kind of legal and people were sort of getting clearances, but before they figured out how to do it properly. So they sort of have perhaps old contracts that make the rebooting a little more difficult. It's right. Kind of like these TV shows that got caught in that nether region with like the Wonder Years and others, where music clearances made it impossible to put them on DVD and Blu-ray for a long, long time. That's why the Carol Burnett Show and the Wonder Years and WKRP and stuff like that remained unavailable for quite a while. But it can be done. And speaking of hip-hop, have you watched the Baz Luhrmann TV show, The Get Down?
I have not started watching that yet because I'm trying to make it through Mr. Robot and season of that.
Where are you on the second season?
Well, I realized last night I watched episode 5 before watching episode 4, or vice versa, 4 before 3. So now I'm like somewhere between 3, 4, and 5, somewhere in that neighborhood.
All right.
Nate Parker. You're going to be hearing that name a lot. He is the co-writer, director, producer, and star of the highly anticipated drama Birth of a Nation. He is seeing his past come back to haunt him. In recent interviews, he acknowledged and talked about going to trial on charges of rape when he was a student at Penn State in 1999. Parker was acquitted on all charges, but speaks mournfully about the decisions he says he made at the time. Unfortunately, that's not the only link. His co-screenwriter, Jean Celestin, who I assume I'm pronouncing his name right.
Well, it's more like Gene, probably, since he's a buddy at Penn State.
Oh, that's true. Gene Celestin, yeah.
I mean, I don't know, but you know.
Well, he was in fact found guilty of sexually assaulting the same 18-year-old female. He appealed the verdict and was granted a new trial, at which point the girl chose not to testify again. Naturally, this complicates the media campaign, so Parker has been out giving select interviews with the hope of making the story old news by the time the film plays in Toronto and then opens for awards season. This is the same film that won the Sundance Film Festival. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for the studio. It does complicate things. It's hard to have a church tour and reach out to church groups. There's a really good link sent to by our resident film critic, Aaron Rich. He sent us a link to Very Smart Brothers, a website I'm not familiar with. But they had a breakdown of this story and why these rape accusations resurfacing isn't because of some conspiracy against the black man.
No.
It was, you know, basically it boiled down to, you know what? He's famous now. Right. Now tens of millions of dollars are being spent on this movie. He's famous at a level he never was before. That's why this story, which everybody knew about, and if you Googled him, you'd find it. It wasn't hidden. That's why it suddenly has new currency. But there's another reason that they talked about a little bit in their commentary and their quote comment section. But it's that people pay attention more now. Maybe 10 years ago, people would have had this story resurface and they would have said, he was acquitted. I don't know. Why are we even mentioning this? You know, why would you even talk about it? They would feel uncomfortable and uneasy raising it up. But the fact that we're in a new era where people say, yeah, you know what? We don't ignore these issues anymore. And the fact that his co-screenwriter was found guilty, ended up the retrial never happened. So that helped him. He never served time, but that really makes it an uglier story. You know, he remained friends with this guy. They were accused of harassing the woman after she came forward and said she was raped by them. You know, it was just a very ugly story. And so I think we're in a new world where these stories don't get brushed aside anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I think in a way he's smart for trying to get out in front of it.
Well, he has no choice. Yeah.
Right. But I don't think it's going to matter. That's, yeah, I think you're right. Years ago, people would have said, well, he's being very honest and open about it. And obviously,
we don't want to talk about it. It's uncomfortable. And right. He was found innocent.
And he's not trying to hide it. And so therefore, let's move on.
It does complicate the story of the movie, which right after people praised it and were excited by the screening, you started to see a lot of stories and commentary and things by critics saying, you know what? There's a lot of flaws too. A lot of people who talked about this movie said, I've been saying for a while now, look, this may not become the Oscar monster that people think, because not that flawed movies don't sweep the Oscars, they do all the time. But there's a fair number of issues about this movie creatively that will, I think, keep it from getting the hosannas that it received at Sundance. But yeah, we'll see.
And remember,
I'm looking forward to seeing it personally.
At Sundance, it's, you know, you're up against other Sundance films, and it's kind of a bubble in Park City for 2 weeks. That said, even the day after the first screening of The Birth of a Nation, there were, you know, you could hear critics at other screenings kind of debating the merits, whether it was good or bad or whether it was a masterpiece or not. And most kind of were erring on the side of it's a good movie, not a great movie.
Right. Well, I'm hoping they'll still work on the score and some of the editing to help make the movie even stronger. I don't know if they have that focus and desire. I don't know whether they think, hey, we got a great movie, or whether they're willing to make some of the changes that seem to be pretty widespread as far as things that could improve.
Now, speaking of legal cases, the Netflix series Making a Murderer has helped Brendan Dassey finally receive justice. A teenager, when the murder took place, the murder that is documented in Making a Murderer, Dassey was coerced into confessing in a murder case almost 2 decades ago. But the series revealed all sorts of damaging information about the police and the conduct of the trial. Dassey's conviction has now been overturned, and he may be free within weeks. Of course, the family of the victims now must wonder again if they'll ever see justice done too. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's certainly a big deal to him. I mean, there are very few documentaries or things you can point to that change the course of justice. You know, The Thin Blue Line, The Jinx, Paradise Lost. It doesn't happen a lot, so it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think Thin Blue Line is kind of the poster child for documentaries that...
Absolutely.
Well, I guess you could also say Blackfish, right? I mean...
That's not quite the... I mean, that reveals wrong, but that's not the same as... Blackfish meaning the SeaWorld?
SeaWorld, yeah. Basically,
I think that changed things in the world, like perhaps, you know, An Inconvenient Truth and other stuff. This, I was thinking specifically of people, you know...
Going free.
In jail for crimes, yeah.
Well, and I think...
I mean, many documentary films are focused on social justice or issues of importance.
One that isn't is Harry Potter.
That's not true.
Oh, I know. And it's not by J.K. Rowling, by the way, this what we're about to talk about. And it's not a novel. But the new play, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, is flying off bookshelves. It sold 3.3 million copies in its first week in North America alone. In comparison, about 3 times as many copies were sold on opening day of the final book in the series. After 1 year, more than 44 million copies were sold of Deathly Hallows in the U.S. Big deal or big whoop?
It's still a big deal. It's a play. The fact that they've sold millions of copies of a play, a new play, is amazing. It's certainly not the most read play of all time, like the UK publisher said. That's just nonsense. But it's great.
Maybe the UK publisher hasn't heard of Shakespeare.
Apparently not. Or high school.
Yeah.
But it's pretty amazing. You know, I've read it now. Anybody want to talk about it? I won't spoil anything. Just call me up and we'll chat up. But there is the issue of queer baiting, which has been brought up in this story. And I agree with those people who raise that as a criticism. But it's part of a good news story for bookstores. Bookstore sales in North America are up 6% for the first half of the year. That's great. In 2015, sales were up 2% for the entire year. That was the first uptick since 2007. So now we're building on that growth. We're growing even faster. Of course, it's still a lot of adult coloring books, but sales are sales.
Well, you know, and I wonder, because as you know, Michael, I know a lot of authors, and I don't mean I know them personally. I know more about them. You know, like I read news stories about them. But lately I've been reading more and more. Granted, I'm reading Proust, and let's face it, his next book is not necessarily coming out anytime soon since he passed away in the, I think, the 20s.
Okay.
I mean, these days, whether it's Colson Whitehead or, I don't know, the Emma Klein with the girls, I'm kind of seeing more and more news stories about books. And I don't mean like just a review, but I mean,
you just think they're getting cultural zeitgeist moment again.
You know what? I don't understand why it is. You can say like in like 5 words what I was trying to say in like 15 sentences. But yes, that is exactly what I'm saying. It used to be everybody wanted to write the great American novel, and everybody wanted to be, you know, Fitzgerald or Hemingway or, you know, insert name of author here. But and then nobody cared for like 40 years. Nobody, you know, between the 70s and 2010, 2012, nobody cared about, you know, books. And I know I'm exaggerating that, but still, they weren't in the zeitgeist, as you say. Now they seem to be kind of taking a turn back toward that. Am I wrong in thinking that?
Probably. I don't know. Maybe books are becoming hip again. You know, certainly this is the era of TV, That's the True. The hip moment, the hip art form of the moment. Everything comes in waves, and no matter how out of it a certain art form is, be it opera or Broadway or punk music, great work is always being done in all those areas. There were great radio plays for decades, even when nobody paid attention to radio plays. So yeah, are more authors gaining more currency again? I think maybe they are. I think I'm seeing that a little bit too, though I was disappointed to see Oprah made Colson Whitehead's book an Oprah book club pick, tons of media attention, did not pop in sales the way I thought it should have. I'm not saying it's not going to be a commercial success, but you know, Oprah used to sell a million copies of a book. She didn't do that with this one. I'm hoping more and more people will gravitate to it. He deserves it. It's a great book.
And this is The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. It is a Book Filter pick of the week.
That's right.
That's right. Bookfilter.com. Little plug there. Okay, Cirque du Soleil. This is the famed troupe, you know, that, and is it a troupe? I guess it is. Troupe of acrobatics. Yeah. They have often tinkered with their shows as they tour the world or have long running sit downs in Vegas and elsewhere. But that's a lot trickier and a lot more expensive, by the way, to do on Broadway. Nonetheless, they're doing an overhaul of the Broadway show Paramore right in the midst of the tourist season. They've spent hundreds of thousands, if not more, to add in and remove all sorts of elements to the poorly reviewed musical. They have more acrobatics that will be added early on in the show. Dialogue will try and beef up the characters. A key visual stunt will be rejiggered so it can be appreciated from every seat in the house. And the finale will be trimmed because audiences enjoyed it, but the sequence went on too long. It's a pricey decision to go dark for four performances, so all these changes can be incorporated. But Cirque says it's worth it since they plan to be around for a long time. You hear that, Broadway? Stop giving us the stink eye. Big deal, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because the show is certainly not a great success yet. It's barely over 50% in capacity and total gross. It should be grossing a lot more given the venue it's in. But they're getting seats, bums in the seats, and they're trying to rejigger the show so that the people who watch it will say, it was pretty good, rather than it was okay.
Yeah, well, there's a marketing issue or a mentality issue. It's a perception issue. It's when I go to Broadway, I don't expect to see Cirque du Soleil because I can go to Vegas to see that, okay? I go to Broadway to see, you know, the next hot musical or a nice revival. You know, I don't, Cirque du Soleil, it just doesn't seem to fit on Broadway.
Well, it's in the $1 million club. We have, because we're recording on Tuesday this week, we have the Broadway grosses, which usually come out Monday afternoon, usually after we've recorded the show. And it's a good summer. The Lion King is number one again. Hamilton is right up there, but it's in so many fewer seats. It's not surprising that the Lion King is back on top. They're both in the $2 million club, but there are 11 shows in all, including those two, that are in the $1 million club. That's if you round up like $10,000 for like Waitress, which is at $990,000 last week. So 11 shows are making about $1 million or more. Les Mis passed 1,000 performances. That's amazing. The revival of Les Mis has passed 1,000 performances. That was a milestone that used to put you in the top 100 shows of all time. Now it puts you, I think, in the top 125 shows of all time. So that is a very successful revival. Waitress is built into a big hit. The Color Purple is really not doing as well since Jennifer Hudson left. Kind of a surprise because her replacement, Heather Headley, got great reviews, but that show misses the drawing power of Jennifer Hudson. So, we've got these shows on Broadway. Paramore is in the mix. And it wants to be around for a long time, and maybe it will be. I never dreamt it would be lasting this long, given the show when I saw it.
Well, let's stick with Broadway for a second. We all know love is a battlefield. Thanks to rocker Pat Benatar, soon Broadway will be too. Benatar hopes to join Carole King, Gloria Estefan, and Frankie Valli with a new musical on stage telling her life story and delivering hits like Heartbreaker, We Belong, and Hit Me With Your Best Shot. It will focus on Benatar falling in love with her lead guitarist, as they conquered the charts and scored Grammys. They're eyeing a 2017 debut on Broadway. Jamie Sessa of Pippin is the producer, and Gary Lennon has signed on to do the book. I think 2017 is when those big shoulder pad outfits will just be back in style. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Okay then.
Yet another rocker wants to hit Broadway.
Okay. Well, then let's move on to Thomas Gibson, who is moving on, actually. Literally. Actor Thomas Gibson has been fired from the CBS drama Criminal Minds after 11 seasons with the hit show. The final straw, per CBS TV studios and ABC studios, was on an on-set dispute with one of the show's writers. Gibson was directing the episode, got into an argument, and reportedly kicked the writer. Never something that's good to do, by the way.
I should never kick you, I take it.
Yeah, please stop. You know, it's especially from a long distance. It really hurts. A previous incident led to Gibson being required to take anger management classes, which led to a bad movie by Adam Sandler and Jack... Oh, wait, no, that was something completely different. In any case, an initial two-episode suspension was changed to Gibson being written out of the show entirely. The plot twist may not seem so traumatic to fans, since the show has seen numerous characters come and go over the years, with season 12 of Criminal Minds proving particularly fluid in that regard. Gibson was recruited, he has recruited top lawyers and is considering a lawsuit over the matter. Of course, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, there have been a lot of changes in the last season. It's a show I never really watched because it was too grim. I'm with Mandy Patinkin on that one. But they fired him, and he's been with the show for 11 seasons. He is the face of the show. And, you know, like we were talking about with Nate Parker's sad story from the past, this stuff normally in the old days, and it got, obviously they overlooked it for a long time, the star of the show got away with a lot of stuff. You know, you treated people poorly, they didn't care. It's been a long run for Criminal Minds, so maybe that makes it easier for them to do this. But they said, enough is enough. They're less willing to put up with this on-set behavior that they probably were putting up with in the past.
Well, also, I think, you know, the last 10, 12 years of television helps as well. And what I mean by that is you have shows like Lost and CSI. On Lost, if you were a character, you could go at any moment. You know, they didn't care whether they killed you off because... You know, That's what they did. And same with The Walking Dead, characters get killed off.
But CSI is a procedural, like Criminal Minds. It's the same people every week, and they didn't disappear.
But they replaced the main characters.
Uh-huh.
Ted Danson.
Well, after many, many, many years. Yeah.
Well, what, 11 isn't enough?
Well, right. But again, it endangers a very profitable franchise. And in the old days, that's a decision they just wouldn't make.
Well, and let me ask you, 11 years, that's the running length of Cheers, right? I mean...
I don't know. Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Which at the time
was. Plenty of shows for syndication, no doubt about that.
Yeah, no. At the time, you know, Cheers, 11 years. It's unheard of. Now it's like 11 years. Good grief. You know, I'm surprised you're still on the show after 11 years. Speaking of criminal behavior, the scandal surrounding former Fox News head Roger Ailes and his apparently aggressive and longtime sexual harassment of women at the network continues to grow.
Talking of stuff that networks look the other way about.
Right. Well, Ailes is out, which is more a testament to a changing of the guard at News Corp than any corporate sensitivity to madmen-like behavior. But this scandal keeps churning up new information. Wiretapped phones of employees, Ailes threatening to have thugs beat up a journalist writing a book on him in Fox News, secret payouts in hush money that weren't properly accounted for, totaling millions of dollars, and more women who say they were bullied, harassed, or simply shunted aside when they wouldn't give in to the intimidation of Ailes. Like the phone hacking scandal in the United Kingdom, this story has legs. And no, Roger, we don't mean the kind you can fondle with impunity. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. They've now put two new people in charge of Fox News, and they're Ailes deputies. Jack Abernathy and Bill Shine will be co-presidents. Abernathy will focus on the backroom side, and Shine will focus on the programming. But their Fox News is just saying, no, we're going to stick with the people that got us here. Is that going to be enough? You know, there's a New York Times profile of them. Is it Bill Shine that they did?
I think so, yeah.
And they're trying to say, oh, he's, you know, he's a good guy. Everybody likes him. He knew nothing about all that. You know, it's like, well, that's a bit of a leap. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like they're hoping they can weather the storm.
Well, and just goes to show you that when you pay out hush money, you better properly account for it.
Exactly.
Game of Thrones may be eyeing the finish line, but its music will live on. Proving the franchise is hugely popular, a concert tour of the music will be hitting 28 cities starting in February. Oh no, you're going to make me...
Aha! You wanted the story, you say the name.
Composer Raman Djawadi will conduct an 80-piece orchestra and choir on a stage in the round, complete with multimedia elements and a red wedding bloodbath at the finale. Actually, that last part isn't true, but there will be a splashy presentation. And by the way, did you hear that I pronounced Raman Djawadi correctly? Big deal.
That was
big
lovely, lovely. This is a big whoop, of course. It's just another iteration of how popular the franchise is. I mean, I certainly wouldn't go, but that's kind of cool that, you know, I think they're three seasons too late. You know, they probably should have done it three seasons ago, but that, you know, that's cool to see how it works. I think you'd be more excited by the tour of French legend Charles Aznavour, who is 92 years old and doing 5 shows in big cities in the U.S.
Yeah, I guess he's playing Madison Square Garden. He's going to Quebec, which makes sense, you know, Montreal, French-Canadian. And he's playing the Pantages Theater in Hollywood, which is where many Broadway shows also play when they tour through Los Angeles. And the reason we included this story, I mean, he's described as the French Frank Sinatra. He was discovered in 1946 by Edith Piaf. Okay, so he's been around a while. Let's face it.
He's 92.
He's 92. But I remember seeing him in his tour of the U.S. in 1979, 1980 at Carnegie Hall in New York.
Wow.
Yeah, and I don't know why I remember
that. And after that tour, he didn't return to the U.S. for 34 years.
Yes, and I do remember that. And I mean, do you think it's worth seeing him at the age of 92? Or is it like, really, why are you trying to...
Well, he's obviously, you saw him as a little kid with your mom. It has a totemic significance for you. It might be nice in that sense. I assume his voice is not what it used to be, but perhaps he's still a charming presence. Maybe look at the reviews of when he came here in 2014 and whether they said, well, it was nice to be in the room with him, or whether they said, no, he still got it.
Okay, hold on. I'm just making a note. Look up definition of totemic. Okay. Larry Wilmore, Comedy Central, well, it just got unblackened. They're keeping it 100% real. And the Larry Wilmore-hosted series, The Nightly Show, has just been canceled. Both it and Trevor Noah's Daily Show are doing poorly in the ratings, especially since it's an election year tailor-made for political comedy. Noah's Daily Show has a 0.3 rating in young demos, while Wilmore's show has a 0.2 rating. Of course, Wilmore has that terrible 0.3 lead-in and the task of facing off against all the major late-night talk shows. So arguably, I guess he's doing better because he's actually keeping some people around. But Noah is playing the viral game, creating short clips and comedy bits that gain at least some traction, whereas Wilmore doesn't have that at all. And that lack of social media traction was the tipping point for the network in making its decision. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, my God, it's a big deal just because of the timing of it.
Yeah.
They said contracts were up and blah, blah. You're telling me you had contracts pegged to go up right before a presidential election year? How stupid was that? I mean,
well,
you know,
I mean,
the
when
idea
you
that
think
they weren't
about
getting traction is dreadful, but surely you did not, surely your decision is BS to say it has to do with the contracts. You're just pulling the plug, but like to do it weeks before the election, unless you've got some other game plan and rerunning the Nerdist, you know, pushing the Nerdist up from midnight to 11:30 is not a game plan to take advantage of the election. It should be a big opportunity. If you don't have something else to go in its place, I don't know why you're pulling the plug weeks before the election.
And by the Nerdist, you mean the show At Midnight, which was at midnight. Okay, that's why the show was at midnight.
It's going to have to change its name.
Yeah, I don't know what.
But that when you're looking at Comedy Central and the cluster, I can't even say it, right? This is a family show. You changed damn in our show notes to darn.
Oh, so did I? When did I do that?
Yeah,
oh,
you did. The,
yeah.
The cluster blah, blah, blah that we have going on at Comedy Central and their 11 to 11:30 p.m. day part, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, and they think Trevor Noah is catching on. Well, more power to you. You're the only ones.
Yeah. I mean, look, when I watch Trevor Noah, he's actually good and he's getting better. Okay.
That's what you say.
Well, look, I watch him like once every 3 weeks. So I used to watch The Daily Show all the time.
Right.
And so what I would say is, how long did it take Jon Stewart to catch on in The Daily Show role? I don't know. I'm asking that kind of, I don't know what the answer to that question is. And I would kind of peg Trevor Noah to that timeline. It's really a shame that they don't have somebody in these roles right now that could take advantage of what is going on, at least in the United States and even in Britain.
Yeah.
I mean, look, John Oliver over at...
they let all their best talent go.
Yeah, they did. And
they let all their best talent go. And one of them would be reasonable, but they screwed up left and right. John Oliver subbed for Jon Stewart. They didn't sign him up to a long-term contract. They needed a new host. They didn't even bother to talk to Samantha Bee, which is insane.
Yeah, they really should
have
talked to her. Yeah, that is... I think she said, look, I'm not going to lie, it kind of stung that they didn't even bother calling.
Well, no joke. Of course it did.
Yeah, and frankly, they should have called.
But the stupidity is theirs, not hers. It should sting them, not her.
Oh, I no doubt about it. I mean, I think they're kind of seeing that now.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I don't know if this week's story will affect you at all, unless, you know, there's a changing of the guard at Warner Brothers, but certainly this
Well, there won't be because of this letter.
No, this is definitely an inside story. So inside, in fact, that a Warner Brothers employee, a former employee named Gracie Law, which means, let's face it, it's an anonymous employee, okay?
Right, it's a pseudonym.
It's a pseudonym. And we have no idea whether this is real, although more and more people have kind of begun to figure out who it is because, well, in the letter, she talks
about... what's going on.
Okay, so she writes this letter that she used to work at Warner Brothers, and she's really disappointed at the current regime, which is led by CEO Kevin Sugihara. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because you might recall the executive bake-off that was started at Warner Brothers several years ago between the head of film and the head of television and the
That's
head
not
of
important.
Home entertainment.
That's not important. He's the head of Warner Brothers.
He's the head of Warner Brothers.
You don't need
now.
To explain who he is by bringing that a whole story in.
In any case, she laments the era when thousands of employees were laid off. She sees one bad movie after another being released by the studio and wonders why it's always the underlings who get fired instead of the people who made the actual bad creative decisions. Case in point, Zack Snyder. Okay, and the writer of this letter sees him delivering the dreadful Man of Steel, followed by the dreadful Batman v Superman. He's overseeing the DC Universe, and now Suicide Squad is so dreadful with what she says is terrible buzz on Wonder Woman, despite the great trailer. Why is he still in charge of DC? This writer wonders.
All right, so here's first of all, this is a letter posted online by an anonymous employee saying, Warner Brothers sucks. Your DC movies suck. Why can't you make better movies? But it's gotten thousands of comments on a website I've never heard of called Pajiba. Have you ever heard of Pajiba.com?
Only, you know, kind of loosely. Not like the Huffington Post, that's for sure.
Right. So this is a fairly new website. And you're saying and arguing that a lot of people in the industry are talking about this letter. Why is that? Why is this letter gaining traction on an relatively obscure website?
Well, first of all... website aside, okay, it hasn't been discredited, this website, and every website kind of has a breakout moment.
I'm just saying it wasn't posted on Huffington Post or, you know, the New York Times. It was posted on a website we hadn't really heard of, and it's gotten a lot of attention. That's very hard for a website to do. Good for them. I'm just saying, why is Hollywood talking about this anonymous letter saying DC movies suck?
Well, as I have said for some time, the scuttlebutt inside the industry is that Warner Brothers, on the film side, I'm only talking the film side, okay, not the television side, but that it's a bit of a mess when it comes to knowing who to go to there. There's three heads. There's, you know, one of marketing. There's a global head of marketing and a worldwide head of marketing. Who do you talk to? Do you go to the global head or to the worldwide head?
But Kevin makes the decisions on what movies get made.
Right, ultimately, because he's the head of the whole studio. So ultimately, what was said in this letter, whether it was written by a former employee or not, and again, more and more people are kind of like triangulating it down to, wait a second, a female employee who left on her own volition, who went to this screening of Suicide Squad. It has to
comic
be this
book fan.
Right, exactly. It has to be this person. And so
there's about four women who fit that bill.
Exactly. So they've pretty much pegged it to, like, as you say, four women.
Which points to the paucity of women at Warner Brothers, not the fandom for women who love comic books.
Right. I think what really took hold here is the fact that everybody has been saying what this letter states. Now, they haven't been saying...
But it isn't talking about the fiasco at the studio and the difficult ways it is for people to... Who's in charge, who's making decisions, they can't get green lights, it's a lot of... It just says, look at all these bad movies. And it doesn't stop with just the DC movies. She talks about a lot of movies that she calls as bad movies or even botched releases of good movies. She mentions The Hobbit Trilogy, Adam Sandler's Blended, Jersey Boys, Jupiter Ascending, Get Hard, Hot Pursuit, Max, Vacation, Pan, Point Break, the new Jungle Book movie, which they're going ahead with, even though Disney's already done their live action remake. She says even when they make a good movie like Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise film, and Man from U.N.C.L.E., they can't deliver at the box office for it.
Or they mess up the marketing campaign.
Right. That's what I just said.
Yeah.
Yeah. They mess it up at the box office, meaning the marketing or whatever doesn't go well. And even a good movie, they can't get traction for. And she talks about Kevin. How do you say his name?
Kevin Sugihara?
Yeah. She talks about Kevin Sugihara and how he personally did a bad job trying to reach out to comic book fans. A dreadful Hall H launch of movies at this year's Comic-Con. At least it's be showing up years ago. Marvel would do great events at Comic-Con and he would have a shareholder conference call. She says, my God, she says, quote, if I worked at a donut stand and I kept effing up donuts, I'd be fired. Even if I made a tiny decent one every now and then, it doesn't matter. I'm going to get fired. I love that studio and you're allowing it to sink. It's not about making movies for the fans and not the critics. It's not even about ruining childhoods. It's about protecting livelihoods. It's time to wake up and make the effing donuts, Kevin. End quote.
Yes, that was a quote directly from Gracie Law, the anonymous writer of this letter.
And it's really struck a nerve. And people are saying, yes, the studio is a mess. And she sort of crystallized that in talking about all the different bad track record of Kevin. And she lays all the blame at Kevin. Is that where all the blame belongs? He is in charge.
Well, I think in part, yes. I mean, because he didn't install somebody like and say, OK, you are the head of the motion picture division. OK, because of that and because he got that job, and the reason I started to kind of mention this whole executive bake-off is he got the main job, the head of film left, the head of television left, or they were summarily fired, basically. In other words, they lost, they didn't win the bake-off, they were executed, so to speak. And they were doing a good job in their roles. Now there's, you know, basically it's kind of a free-for-all over there, it seems like.
All right. Well, is there any counter story to make? Because that's what I'd like to do.
Well, here's the counter story is that, and it's kind of a lackluster counter story. Suicide Squad is released. And yes, everybody who sees it says it's a horrible movie. Okay. The critics say so.
Obviously, you'd rather have a Marvel movie or you'd rather have a film that everybody loves, like The Dark Knight.
Right. But it's making a mint. Okay. And it will probably break even. The problem that I see with that is that they didn't make a good movie. And so they won't lose their shirts this time around on this particular film, but they didn't exactly set up a franchise for the long term. So they kind of have a short term semi win for definitely a long term loss.
Because the difference is with Transformers, at least the fans liked it.
Right. Correct.
You know, crappy movies, but, you know, people enjoyed it and they went to see them again. They weren't seeing it and saying, oh, it's so bad. Going again and again, they actually liked it. God knows why.
Well, but, that's for the first like three movies. By the fourth movie, they were like, okay.
Well, eventually every movie runs out of steam. Yes.
Right.
But however, a lot of these movies she points to are money makers. The Hobbit fiasco made money. Adam Sandler's Blended, a hit.
Was it?
Absolutely. The budget was very, yeah. I went through, and you can look in our show notes. I went through, he took over in 2013, in January of 2013. I only started with 2014 movies because you figure movies, even some of these movies were in the pipeline before he, you know, but he was in charge solidly by the time they came out in 2014 and beyond. And there are a lot of hits. There aren't a lot of good movies. Basically, you've got Mad Max Fury Road, which was not a commercial success, but again, in accounting terms, did not lose them money. And you've got Creed, that was a critical and commercial success. And you got a lot of bad movies, but a lot of movies made money. And when you look at the movies that weren't out and out box office hits, a lot of them are more in the break even, not so bad category.
Not
so
Pan. I'm only looking. Pan was a huge flop.
Every studio has huge flops. Every studio. But when you look at the list of their movies, of course, yeah, they have Pan and they have Jupiter Ascending, but they have a lot of movies that made hits. The Lego Movie, Godzilla, Blended cost $40 million to make and grossed $130 million. Tammy, the Melissa McCarthy movie, If I Stay, Interstellar, The Hobbit, American Sniper. In 2015, you've got another seven or eight movies. In 2016, How to Be Single, Batman versus Superman, Barbershop, The Next Cut, Me Before You, The Conjuring 2, Central Intelligence, Lights Out, Suicide Squad. Now you're looking at, very interestingly, a lot of movies in 2014 to 2016 that are pretty modestly budgeted and they made a lot of money on.
So I guess the counter argument here would be, yes, the high profile movies like Suicide Squad and Batman v Superman are disasters. Okay.
They're making money.
They're critical
hits.
Disasters and they barely make money. And yeah, they're not going to, you know, light the world on fire or relaunch any franchises. However, the reason you keep your job is because you actually are making money. It's just that you're making money
3 years in a row.
You're making money on these films that are, you know, $10 million to make and make $50 million at the box office.
No, they also have substantial, you know, the Lego movie was only a $60 million bet, but Godzilla was a $160 million movie. Interstellar was a $165 million movie. The Hobbit 3 was a $250 million budget. San Andreas, $110 million budget, quadrupled that budget.
What is Interstellar a Warner Brothers movie?
It's on their list.
Okay, yeah, maybe it was. Yeah.
$165 million budget. It grossed $675 million worldwide. Would they have preferred a billion? Of course. You know, it's coming off the Dark Knight movies. But yes, Batman versus Superman more than tripled its budget. That was a $250 million budget. Suicide Squad also. There are big bets here that have paid off. But there are also, very smartly, a lot of medium and small bets that they're really capitalizing and making a lot of money on. So that's a very, you know, me before you. $20 million budget. That has grossed almost $200 million worldwide.
By the way,
you know, that adds up.
Interstellar was a Paramount film that Warner Brothers had internationally.
Distributed internationally, which is where it made most of its money.
Yeah, exactly. I thought right. So. I was like, wait, I don't remember that being a Warner Brothers.
Well, you know,
Brothers
they had a piece of it because he made all the Dark Knight movies.
Right, so they threw in, yeah, co-financed.
Right. Well, so yeah, do they have flops? Every studio has flops. You know, Edge of Tomorrow, Man from U.N.C.L.E., they didn't lose the bank on that one. Pan was a terrible flop. Jupiter Ascending was a terrible flop. I don't know what their exposure was on those movies, but they could probably tell you. Jersey Boys, not a big budget movie. Get Hard, Hot Pursuit, Max, Vacation, not big budget movies. All of those are kind of like, eh, they didn't lose their shirt. They probably did fine when all was said and done.
But I guess also when you look at, okay, you're not losing money, but you're certainly not making...
Well, no, but yeah, but I'm looking at all those movies that they made money. They've got 3 years of a very strong box office. Their movies are making money. What's the problem? You know, do you want critical and commercial joy? Of course. But as a studio head and you're a shareholder or you're saying, what bad job is he doing? He's making money.
Yeah, well, and that might be the counter story here is, you know, you can say that it feels like a mess.
Yeah. Of course you want everything. You want Oscar glory and critical and fan love. But, you know, they're still pulling it off.
And of course, you want a gold medal. Let's face it.
Absolutely.
And what do you think? Do we get a gold medal for this week or no?
At least a silver.
Okay. So
silver's the worst, by the way.
Oh, and I know this. Your theory on this. Gold, hey, you came in first and you're a hero. Right. Bronze, right. You can at least say, well, at least I won a medal. You know, I could have been worse. I could have, you know, come in fourth and that would have been horrible.
Silver, I should have dived.
Yes.
I was 1/100th of a second behind the winner. 1/100th of a second.
I mean, when you look at that, like, I think she was 7/100th of a second. Yeah. I mean, and this is the runner, Felix, I think is her name. She lost to the Bahama
woman who dove at which is the worst thing in the world you can do. That's the in baseball, never dive, that slows you up. But it was amazing, she made it across the finish line first.
Yeah,
thank God she didn't hurt herself.
I know, I was really, I mean, when you look at the end of that, I mean, oh my God, it's dramatic.
So give us a silver so we can try and do better next week.
Yes, and one way to do that is to subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, or the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, or aggregate podcasts, you can find our show. And if you can't, please let us know. Please rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us, ways to follow us. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle on Twitter, or you can like us on Facebook, where if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. You can also email us. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's yoigotyourbackkevin.com.
And I think you just said Kevin because you didn't want to have to say Kevin Susie Hara. .com.
Perhaps.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work there, try, I don't know, head on over to the Huffington Post, and apparently you're going to have to search quite hard to find his work there on covering the
entertainment. No, just search for my name or, you know, homepage. You can get an alert every time I post a new story, or you can bookmark the page where they list all my stories. So that's the way to do it.
Oh, okay. Or you could go to michaelgiltz.com where all of his work is aggregated. And of course, check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.